in that, and I'm going to take care of it.
Amen.
I'm grateful to be another day in my heart, and I'm grateful to be sober another day, and most of all, I'm grateful to be alive another day. Those things are possible to make the day because of the program of alcohol phenomenon of my heart sorrow and choose to call God. And I say that all the time. You know, because when I came to alcohol phenomenon, I wasn't grateful for anything. If I could have been dead, I would have been grateful for that and that only. You know, I used this car, I went to take it for my car, my fourth step, and that. So I had the biggest change in my life. My way of thinking of stuff is when my parents got divorced when I was in the third grade, and I felt lost and abandoned and no hope, and I'd gone to church before that, and I cussed God more than why he was sticking on me. And I never realized that my other brothers might be feeling the same. But I hated my parents for that. I wondered what I did wrong. I wondered, if I could have been a better kid. Things might have been different, just all that kind of thinking. And the next thing that came to me was I didn't want to think that way. I wanted to be happy, and I didn't want to feel like that. And I remember my parents having dances and parties and everybody drinking and laughing and having fun. So that's why I started drinking in third grade, to be happy. And when I started drinking, my mom's food that she had stacked away in drawers and stuff, it didn't make me happy, and it didn't make it all exciting, and it made it okay enough to say, Danny, world, it don't matter. And, I go to school, and I went to a small school in Clovis, and everybody knew everybody, and all the kids I was going to school with, their parents were divorced, and they pick on me because I didn't have a daddy at home, and I tell them, yes, I did, and they tell me, no, I didn't. And, I was a 15-year-old kid. I'd cry, and I'd want my daddy to show up so I could prove to him that I had a dad. My dad was real strict. He was a type that he went to the kitchen table to eat, not to bullshit. He said one word, you got the hell slapped out of you. If you got in the car, it was to drive from one spot to another, not to bullshit, not to play games. If you wiggled or anything, you got the hell slapped out of you. If I was scared to do anything, or I'm scared to think wrong. And so I never fought, and I never did anything. And then now I have to deal with all this. The kids picking on me. And I got tired of that. Every day going to school, the kids picking on me. One day I took a drink. I started drinking again, and I found I could go to school, and those kids were picked on me. I could whip their asses. I wasn't because I was a bad dude or anything. It's just I was a raging idiot right from the start when I drank. And I got scared the hell out of me, and I could win fights. And other kids had girlfriends, and I found out in grammar school that I could drink, and I could talk to girls. And I continued drinking, and I found out I could drink and do burglaries and go to department stores and rip them off, and I wasn't afraid to do that when I drank, and God, I thought I found the most wonderful thing in the world, And at that time it took care of everything that I needed it to. So I had a 7th and 8th grade dance was started, and I couldn't dance. I couldn't even ask the girl for a dance. The only reason I could dance was sometimes they made the boys go on one side and the girls on the other side. And you go around meet the center and after you have a dance with them. And I could do that, because that was a mandatory thing you had to do. But just to go ask the girl to dance, I couldn't do that. And I found out I could drink it, and the girls were lucky to have me there to ask me. my grandfather, he died of alcoholism, and I was never going to be like him, my dad would go pick him up, and I'd be able to visit my dad, and he'd trip and shit his pants, and he was a disgusting human being, I was never going to be like that. He'd run away from wherever he was at, and go to bars, and haul off the bar stools, and break tips, and, just a disgusting human being. I was never going to be like that. And, you know, that bugged me when I was drinking in grammar school. And you know, I just knew I'd never be like that. You know, it was where he was raised or something like that. His parents didn't, you know, treat him right. He was just to yourself, and you know, I wasn't going to be like that. I was never going to get out of control like that. And you know, I was never going to take drugs. You know, that was, God, you were really a scummy not to take drugs. And through drinking enough, I guess, on my 13th birthday, I moved away from home when I was 13. And I guess I got drunk enough, and I was living with some health angels, and I must have said yes, and I took some drugs. And I woke up the next morning, and I couldn't function, and I hated myself for taking drugs. And I got introduced to this tea, you know, to make it to work. And got to work, and I guess I'd taken too much speed, and that was the first day I had to drink on the job. 13 years old, first day of being 13, had to drink to come down off that speed sign. It just continued on like that, you know, and then so I justified about, I'm not a bad person, you know, the scumbag people are the ones that stick needles in their arms and go to prison, and, you know, those disgusting kind of people. So I'll never be like that. And through drinking and using some on my 15th birthday, I'm addicted to all kinds of things. Women was one of my budget. You know, my 15th birthday, there was a good-looking blonde, and I was drunk enough again because I'd shoot some heroin and cocaine, and she looked good, and I decided that dope couldn't be that bad, and I stuck it into my arms. I remember I hated myself the day after that, and it was all to hell with it. I'm a bad kid anyway. I didn't go into juvenile halls, you know, for having fun, you know, jumping public and assaulting batteries and slapping my mom through plate glass windows, you know, and just trying to make me mine, and, you know, beating the hell out of my dad because he'd tell me I was on the house of mess. You know, people didn't understand, you know, it was my parents' fault, and the cops, you know, they just didn't understand the problems I had, but they did, they wouldn't arrest me, and, you know, they were kicking me out of high school, after high school, you know, and they didn't understand, and, you know, I decided, you know, it was okay to shoot dope up, and then I got into shooting the booze up, because it worked so good with the dope, and you know, that's when I really discovered how good like Kilo Gold was and things like that. You know, you could shoot up a syringe full of Kilo Gold and fall down on your knees and your head would be dingier in hell and say, man, that shit's, you know, really good. And you know, it just didn't matter anymore. I had my head on a bad kid and there wasn't no hope for me. And you know, my main goals in life when I was a teenager was to turn 18. Because then, you know, I was a hard dude then. I rode motorcycles, I fought on a daily basis, and I got kind of just stabbed and shot at. And you know, that was a good life. You know, because nobody picked on me, nobody took advantage of me, everybody was scared of me. But the only problem I had then in life was, you know, when you're a tough dude, that ain't cool calling mom and daddy coming to jail to the home. And that's like the hell of me. So my lifelong dream was turning 18 so I didn't have to call mom and daddy come get me no more out to the home. And 3 months after I turned 18, my wish came true. And I went for armed robbery and attempted murder and I shot a cop. I didn't even place. So much more I had to call mom and daddy come get me out of the jail, that didn't work, you know. I had to call them. And I was drunk and loaded when I did that. You know, I had the money for a drug deal, and once again we met these girls and somewhere in the money pit, you know. And the drug deal was going to go down later on that night, but I had to have the money, and the restaurant looked real good, and Pardini's restaurant in front of them, it looked real good. We knew rich people went there, so there'd be lots of money there. And I got bailed out of jail, And I had to go buy a part for my car, and there was a kid there that had beat up on my dad in front of 10 years before that, something like that, you know. So I see him walking down the street, and I beat the hell out of him, and arrest for assault and battery. This was only 6 hours after I just got out of jail for armed robbery. And I thought that's why I did this, and you know, that was logical to me. He beat the hell out of my brother 10 years ago. So it was only right he got the hell beat out of him. And it just started going on like that, you know. That, and before I was even 18, it was drinking and then taking drugs on a daily basis and getting in trouble and going to jail. You know, I got to do something to keep me out of trouble. It wasn't losing the drugs, you know. I'm a tough guy. I can handle that shit. You know, I prove it on a daily basis. I go to work and I take care of it, you know. So I knew that with just being a math kid, my parents would only raise me right. You know, this was real hard to be able to speak like this, you know, because I loved my parents to death. You know, I lived for the day they both were dead. And the first time my mom ever listened to me speak was really hard. She's here tonight, I'm grateful. She's part of my sobriety and in my life. And my dad still won't have anything to do. You know, my dad still practicing alcoholics. He's still in denial, and he won't even listen to tape of mine. And for a couple of years of sobriety, he even said, you know, it's just a passing thing, you know. He was drinking again. And, you know, he doesn't want to look at his own alcoholism. So it's really hard when my mom first listened to me. You know, there's an excuse that my parents would have raised me right, and then it's all their fault to get a divorce. So if I get married, they'll take care of it. You know, if I got married, and she was supposed to be pregnant, and a year and 9 months later, the kid came. So I blamed the marriage on her, why he was always doing the shit. She lied to me, and, you know, I never looked at it. Me working downtown all the time, and doing the things of coming home, you know, making really, really good money, you know, out of a brick, and I made really good money. And you know, I couldn't even pay the PG&E bills and stuff, and trying to explain that to the wife that's pregnant and stuff, why you don't have no money, you know, and, you know, the cost of living out of town to work, you know, but that's why I told her I worked out of town, to make extra money, and, you know, let's go into the bars and the wild women and the good drugs, and having nice motorcycles and trust the girls out of town. So anyway, that marriage went, and I moved different places, knowing that was the problem. You know, it was the friends where I grew up with, and you know, the one where I thought I found heaven was I moved to Reno, Nevada when I was, I don't know, 18, something like that. And I didn't know enough to handle drinking. And I moved up there, and I found 24-hour drinking, 24-hour gambling, and for $10 you spend all night at the whorehouse, and I thought I found heaven. And then I immediately found people that tried out heroin, and what I got to do is, you know, seems no matter where I go, you know, people are screwed up if I could only meet the right people. You know, never dawned on me. I didn't go up there looking for people that went to church or didn't drink or anything, you know. So I came up with another brilliant idea. The United States government would make me mine. Vietnam War was going on. I was going to join the service. And I went and joined the service, and they almost didn't let me in because of my records. And, you know, because I had problems with drugs, and I had problems with being around and shooting people. And I thought I was a prime candidate, what they need for Vietnam, you know, to go over there and kill people. I had to argue with them for a long time. They were worried, they said they were worried about our own guys over there, which was kind of like my record and my attitude. And so they finally let me in, and you know, I told them how bad I need to be in the service, and they finally let me in. And, well, I think I get projected into that in the service. They like to tell you what to do, and you're not supposed to tell them how to run things. So I got into trouble the first day I was there, and you know, I could always find a solution. You know, they put me in this room, there's one door and no windows because I beat up the sergeant. And all these duffel bags and a case of spray paint and a stencil to paint those duffel bags. And they tell me they're going to leave me in there all day and fitting in nothing. I said, well, I'm going to show them. I spray paint. It took me 12 duffel bags and spray paint and a stencil on there to figure out the solution. That paint will get too high. And when they walked in that evening to get me out of there, they had to carry me out. And I only had 12 duffel bags of spray paint and all the paint was gone. And I had it all on my face, and I didn't really show them, and they put me in the stockade, and I got out there, and I had a bad problem of them telling me what to do, and I had a bad problem of their face getting like this, and me going back to the stockade, and I go lay wall to show them, and they take me back. And one time now, they got in trouble, and they sent me to the federal penitentiary. And, you know, I really thought, you know, I was in a big shot at the real early in life. And I was in jail a little over 30 days, and I got sent to the federal penitentiary, and I was in there 33 days, and got out on appeal with a condition that the United States government got me back. Went straight from there to the stockade and was in there 34 days, I think it was, and got out with a discharge. So it was only a little over 3 months. I was in and out of jail, prison, and the army, and I got out being happy. I'm in the United States government now, and I tell them what to do, and they do it. You know, and I took off really bad after that. You know, it was like nobody or nothing could stand in my way. And, you know, I kept going to jail. I ended up with 13 drunk driving convictions. My 13 drunk driving, I had to go to a 5x5 program for a year. They say when you come here, you have to be willing to hear the things you need to hear. And I guess I wasn't willing to hear nothing at 5x5, because the only thing, out of a whole year of going to there, these 23 weeks of therapy, the only thing I can ever remember hearing was that alcoholics, they beat their wives, they don't come home, they spend money, they have strange girlfriends, they end up in strange towns, and I said, God damn, that's me. I'm not fighting with no more, I'm not dead, I'm drunk, I'm an alcoholic, and I went home, I think it was my fifth wife then. And proceed to probably tell her that I'm an alcoholic. Don't ever question me why I don't come home no more, why I do this thing. I really set me off running really good. You know, God damn. You know, if that's the things you're supposed to do, I'm going to make sure I do it. Make sure I don't let down what I am. So I ended up going through some more marriages and I don't know, you know, it was hard for me when I got here because 10 years before I got the program, I was calling Sonoma, so I didn't ever get arrested anymore. I never looked at it that, you know, how pissed off I was at DA Friend that he gave me a solution to be able to drink and drive. And I remember I was driving him because I was most awake to that 5x5 program when he told me, you're a company you can take and it does work. I got arrested. I don't know how many times and they gave me a breath test. That's the only one that works on the breath test. The state of California says you have to take one of the three and you get your choice. And it does work. You know, I've never told anybody what it was, but it does work. And I never looked at that. I could go into jail for drunk driving and stuff because I had this one to feel like could take it and not get arrested. I get arrested, but they release me. I kept getting married, and so I found that hard to believe that I was an alcoholic. You know, because, I mean, I was blown to say I was alcoholic so I could beat the wife and stay gone and do those kinds of things. But me, an alcoholic, was a bum out on the rail tracks. So I was getting ready to die. Didn't have no place left to go. At 97 years old, It was out on the mountain with the classic days and on earth before he died. And I didn't even quit drinking. You know, it was so young, it was like, oh, man. And, I never looked at, I like the way Seth speaks, but it's like a rubber ball, the first time it bounces, it comes back up almost the same height, and every time it bounces, it's less and less and less. And, when I got into sobriety, I heard that I could look at my life, because, I used to buy new cars, and I used to hang on to my business for years at a time, and through the years of the descriptive disease of alcoholism, I was still driving nice cars, but they got the used ones, and then they got the older ones. I wasn't hanging on to my business as long, and I wasn't staying married as long, and, I didn't look at those things. My last couple of years of drinking, I could stand it. To take a drink was like to intensify all the anger and the hatred that I had for myself and for the world. And I got married the seventh time, and God was going to try to make that work, because I was living in the bar, nagging in the bar, and I moved my travel trailer on the side of it, and wasn't even going to work in my business anymore, just working at the bar and living in it 5 hours a day. That furthest I'd ever gone downhill, and here this girl I thought was a queen, we started going together, and it was going to be this very good film, right? I was going to get, this was going to be the end of all my destruction, and I was going to change, and she made me promise I'd never stick another needle in my arm. And there was a very good tale, guys. We had the ranch and the pigs and the chickens and the goats and the cattle. We had another baby, but she wanted me to drink certainly because I wasn't mean on drinking those kinds of things. And she wanted me to take those a certain way because I stay home on certain types of goats. But I couldn't survive in the world that way. And I started getting out of town work again. I started coming home, and she's ready to tell him, I'm ready to tell him. Because that's where I needed to survive in the world. It wasn't even thinking about, I have to work today, let's go get messed up with drinks and beer on the job site and have fun. It was just something I had to do. I drank at work, I took drugs at work. I took whatever I had to take to work, and I had to take downers and whatever it took to go sleep a while and take blues, straight blues with me in case I woke up in the middle of the night, shaking like hell stone all over me and guzzle enough to get back to sleep for a little while and wake up and just do it all over again. And I had to do that to survive. And I come back in town and I kick her out and tell her what a hard bitch she was. This was the fairy book film, right? That was, I wanted, and I was going to make it happen. And one time she would come back and drunk and loaded, and here I go all over again. And my first wife had done that, took the kids and ran, and I'm worthless, and I'm a scumbag for everything I've done, and she's doing it to me again. I came up with another solution. I'll take that shotgun, and I'll go blow her head off, and I'll take my baby and the money I got from her. And I got over there, and she wasn't home, and I kicked the door, and people see me go in, and I'm sitting there guzzling another bottle of champagne, and it was going through my head, they know what a crazy bastard I am, and they're going to call the cops. The cops are going to come. I'm going to have to shoot it out for them, and I couldn't do that. I couldn't shoot another cop. I was just going through my mind, guzzling that champagne off. Just a sorry human being I've always been. I couldn't go through another herd and never seen another kid, and there just was no hope, and the world was there off without me. And I was crying like hell, and I stuck that shotgun in my head, and I pulled the trigger, and that's what you see here. I've had 41 surgeries of sobriety to get my face as far back as the other. That's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I get in and out of the network, I've had overdoses, I've had suicide attempts. So now here I am, strapped to bed one more time with leather restraints, strapped so tight I can't nothing, and 100% blind, still mostly blind. I mean, it's just a blur here, you know. I'm 100% blind to pain, man. I'll never walk. You know, if I did live, you know, I wouldn't die any day. But no, I wouldn't live. I'd never talk, and I'd never walk, and I'd never see, and I'd never nothing, you know. And I was told that on a daily basis. And then these assholes from Alcoholics Anonymous would come up there every day and ask if they could read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't look at my head, no. I couldn't say no. And they'd sit down and start reading it. I hated that, you know. And the thing I hated worse was I was 100% blind, so if I ever did live through it, I couldn't see any EMF later. Today I'm truly grateful that they did come up there. And I went to my first meeting, and that's when I got out of the hospital finally. Not because I was an alcoholic or I wanted to go, but I sat there and self-pity my alcoholic to take me back to take care of me. And 75% of my face was gone, and I had tubes stuck on me everywhere. And I had these tubes on me, and in the pockets were drainage from the inside of my head. And I had tubes taped to the sides of my head. That's how I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I sat on the couch, you know, I need to tell you, I write down about in the hospital, when they loosen my arm up enough, I write to my family that death cure me bad enough, I'll never take another drink or another shrimp ever in my life. Death cure me bad enough. The second night out of the hospital, I was eating cocaine and drinking champagne, celebrating how stubborn I had been trucking. I went to that first meeting because I was in self-pity and the cell was out for 24 hours a day. And so I went with my brother-in-law to my first meeting. And then I was mad at him after we got there. Well, first off, it was a just rider, you know. He had this, he called it a dog, I call it a horse, they don't say. He had this beat-up old Toyota and it was right on top of, it was sitting on the top of the car and aiming me, so the top was all caved in. So I just had sleeves and we tried to, the first meeting, my head flopped with sleeves, you know. I tell him how he needs to aim, man. He ain't got a car worth a shit, you know. And we got there and people started talking about their opinions and that pissed me off that he told them about it. And I thought they were picking on me, a blind guy. And that was really cold to these people. And I got up to leave and they had a little bit of reality. Then I didn't even know where the goddamn door was, so I had to sit back down and they ain't picking on me. And then I, you know how we think we're doing when we get here, you know, I figured it all out, you know. Room full of goddamn queers. You know, where I came from, you know, we rode motorcycles and fought and drank and we shot each other and stabbed each other and, you know, dancers didn't hug each other. And I'm in this meeting and these guys are talking about loving each other and hugging each other. And I knew they brought me to, you know, I remember sitting there wondering if all aliens were full of prayers and stuff. And I could hardly wait for that first meeting to get up and over it, and it was over, and everybody was saying their goodbyes, and I knew we were close to the door because I could still crash there, but I just still didn't know which way it was, and that's when I thought they were really tricking shit again, because me being blind, they'd sneak up on me and hug me. I like it, you know. And they tell me, yeah, keep coming back. And I said, okay, I'll come back tomorrow and make your life miserable. And that was my main purpose to come back to AA, was to make your life as miserable as mine. And I was crying. The next 15 thing happened was I was there 45 days, and you guys were still signing in as a newcomer. And the 45th day, I said, no, I ain't doing that shit no more. And they go, I go, get me out of here. And they go, what's wrong with that? You guys are chicken shit, taking advantage of a blind guy. I get here 45 days, and you guys still signing in as a newcomer. I ain't taking it no more. And they go, well, man, you got to quit drinking. So that was my next reason for not drinking with all they didn't sign me out of a newcomer. And you know, they got all these suggested things to do and I didn't do none of those and I didn't drink for 6 months. And you know, everybody was on my ass, guess what? And so after 6 months of not drinking and living in hell, telling you guys I was all perfect and fine and oh man, it couldn't be better and I could die on a daily basis. You know, and in the meantime, his wife would kick me back out too, and I'm going through surgery after surgery, and after 6 months, I asked the guy to be my sponsor, and he said, yeah. I thought, all right, as long as I'm finding a secret around here, so I'll be okay. You know, he's going to tell me the secret now. So we went out, did a step call, and I got there, and we did the third step prayer and everything, and he borrowed $10 from me later on that night, and told me he took me up the next day. He goes, it knew me, and I never saw him again. And I said, hey, bullshit don't work. And that was a good enough excuse for me to start drinking. And if I started drinking again, and you know, I didn't work the steps. I did, all I did was go to meetings every day. That's all I did. Take care of the stories. And I didn't do nothing. And so, I came up with, how do I get these guys to quit taking me to meetings? And so I came up with a perfect solution. I thought I moved way, way out. I lived just a little bit in the country. I moved way out of the country and they won't come pick me up no more. And it didn't stop. They keep coming, picking me up and taking me to meetings. And I tell them, well, I'm going to drink. And you drop me off. And they said, I came out for nothing. We'll pick you up tomorrow. See you at the meeting. And I go ahead and I get the ball out of the tent. And the big plate glass window comes up with the news and to show them, you know. And I'll show them some of the bitches that any bullshit don't work. And then I go to meetings, and they take me to meetings, and they talk about how spiritual they felt for picking me up and everything, and how good they felt. I'm thinking, something's wrong, man. They're feeling good, and I'm feeling like shit. And I'm drinking, and they're not. And I wanted to die on a daily basis, and I did die in a lot of surgeries, and they'd bring me back, and my doctors talked surgeries a lot, and they said they knew I wanted to die, and they went to go on with surgeries with me that way, and by the time I'd been around here for 13 months, you know, drinking every so often, and I didn't have no other way to live. I didn't have the steps to live on. I didn't have the people around here to help me, and I took another overdose. I saved all my pills for all those months from surgery, because I knew it was going to be a downward effect on the world again. And I ate 400 and something vitamins and synthetic heroin pills, and I don't know all what was in there. And a couple 2.5 gallons of vodka and went into another coma. And I came 2 or 3 days later, and I wasn't dead. And I guess I pushed some things around the program, and that's when I became willing to go dating late. And that day was this January 26th, will be 3 years ago. And I remember hearing the God thing, you know, and I didn't want nothing to do with God, because if there was a God, I'd broken all 10 commandments, and there wasn't no hope. And the last thing was definitely putting the shotgun in my hand, pulling the trigger, you know, there was no doubt whether that was doing suicide or not. And so there wasn't no hope for me. If I didn't want nothing to do with God, you know, I say this for any prayer in the Lord's Prayer, but in the meantime, I wouldn't say the word God. Yeah, I was 2 weeks of tandem, I was 2 weeks of anything, and I rolled on my knees out of that bed. I thought $70 million, probably this was worthless for me. But I had to try something. So my first prayer was, if there's an MF up there, you better do something, because I can't no more. And I didn't think my life changed. You know, I didn't realize that I became willing to work this program. So that's the way it's been for me. It seems like I don't see the progress I'm going through right now. You know, but I can look back 6 months ago and I can see how much I've changed. And I started doing anything they suggested. You know, I didn't care what it was, you know. One thing I always like saying that is they say there's no ultimate authority and no power in the meeting, and that's bullshit. Yeah. You watch me grab a cup of coffee and watch everybody scatter. And they get blind. I got coffee talking to me, I got a lot of power. You know, the guys like being so cool, you know, and I was amazed. Wait for it. Even though I went to say fellowship, I still tried acting like I wasn't blind, and
and I trip over everybody by saying like I wasn't blind. I went and asked people for shit, and you know, coming over there, I thought I was going to get a lie a lot too. I didn't have to know about the people. And I mean, that first 13 months, I did things like, I can't look those, you know, they keep saying F on the wall, but that's not for me, then I'm blind, I can't read them. And then my home group went together and they bought me the tape from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did things like, well, I'm going to go home and listen to all them tapes all in one night, and I'll be well. And I went home and listened to them all that night, and came back more screwed up than yesterday. And then a lady that's sharing me, and I love very dearly, she gave me the... And I said that, I'm trouble working the steps in the big book, his phone's on, and you go, okay, I can discuss them, but I can't read. But she gave me his phone, so I'm chasing. And I'm really grateful for that. But you know, they told me that services is one of the main keys to this program. And so, okay, well, I got to do it. I'm 28 days over, they told me, okay, go down to Zoom the hall. We need you down there. And, it's so cool, you know. You don't ask questions, you know. I was always so cool. I wouldn't ask the age that I was, or anything that had initials. I just sat around like I knew what everything was. Today I asked a lot of questions. Because today I don't want these students that are looking cool. But, you know, I wouldn't ask for rides. And I went down to the zoo in the hall, and I saw a lady there from Wakefield, and they said, okay, go on in. I go, well, where's the rest of the people? They go, nobody else is coming. And, you know, I heard a door click, so I knew that I'd been locked up enough. I knew that the way in. And I was too cool to ask even once I got in the corridors inside where to go in the meeting. So the guy didn't get much of that first meeting because 45 minutes of the first hour of meeting, and I was wandering around the hall looking for it. And it says that I've gotten involved in February of the 3 years I've been involved in 8-9 hospitals and institutions. I mean, you know, the being cool and not asking, you know, I always thought, boy, he needs to be the guy who runs this facility, but I never would ask how or why. And it took me a lot longer than it probably should have, but, you know, today I'm the coordinator of 4 facilities, you know, and I go into the prisons, and I run a lot of the 8-9 stuff, or Area 92, which is Fresno. And I just got really involved in service, you know, the triangle, the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it is, in that circle, it is the steps and the traditions and the service. You know, through the service work in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned to be of service in the world. You know, outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned how to care for other people and how to do things. You know, like tomorrow I'm going on the holiday project. You know, the first year I didn't like doing that. You know, with the fear of something I haven't done before. I've had a lot of fears. I've had the not pause and numbness, but they've always turned out good. You know, I've spoken at colleges on suicide and drugs and alcohol, and you know, it's scary doing that. And they need to have a sponsor book to things like that. You know, call up and tell them, get your ass over here. Oh, well, you're my sponsor, I think I'll see that. Get your ass over here. You're going to help now, you know. And I've done that quite a few times. And he's always been there. You know, I didn't want to sponsor Guy for the program, and Dan sponsored, I don't know, 25, 28 guys, something like that. You know, a lot of people go, how can you sponsor that many guys? And usually most of them don't call. You hear from every 6 months they want to borrow something, you know. Because I don't have that many men that use me. And, you know, I can't make those guys call me. And, you know, it's a shame they don't, because I know they're going to end up drinking and they're going to end up dying. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. They have to want it as bad as I want it. You know, it's been painful sponsoring some guys. So last year, I didn't tell them I'd be a drunk for last year. This time last year I had two of them got drunk Christmas, and I thought, all of a sudden I'm taking all this on me, you know. What am I doing wrong as a sponsor? And it was a good joint experience, but then I had one got drunk on New Year's Eve, and then I had one got drunk on Super Bowl Sunday. That guy, I knew, I got my last drunk was on, I drank 2 beers, so the last time I had a drink was on Super Bowl Sunday, so I gave that guy for drinking on that day. And then February 4th last year, I had a guy drink himself to death, I sponsored, and it really tore me up. And once again, I used my sponsor, I called up and called him, F them guys that sponsor, F anybody else that asked me to be a sponsor. I'm a terrible sponsor, and he walked me through that and helped me on that. Yeah, you know. I'm on my second term of being a DSR. I can't say enough. If anybody's trying to get in the program and you haven't gotten involved in service yet, I can't express how important it is to get involved in service, some kind of service, to stay involved, you know. I heard a speaker here about 6 months ago that he said there's two kinds of people that go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the 4 years I've been around here, I know it to be true, you know. He said there's a type of people that go to meetings, and that's all they ever do is just go to meetings. He said all they're doing is hanging out there until they go get drunk and die. You know, then there's another type of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, there's a type of people that give them the service, some type of service, and they stay in service with me. They find the peace of mind and find a way to get a service in the world and to be okay. And they end up staying sober like that with peace of mind the rest of their life. And for me, that's been true. And for most of the people I see around, that's the way it happens. So they get drunk again. They don't get involved. Don't get in the service. You know, I've got my kids back in sobriety. I've gotten a lot of material things. I've gotten a peace of mind. I've got this. You know, I love the human being I am today. You know, for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted what everybody else has. And today, I'm grateful I have what I have. You know, if you're fairly new, don't put no limitations on what can happen to you as you get sober. You know, this blind guy, and this person, this worthless piece of me that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and have the life I have today, you know, you can do it too. And I got my driver's license actually enjoying the sobriety. You know, don't put no limitations on it. You know, that one I thought was a joke. You know, it's gonna be a joke that I can get my life. I thought, I'll get a change of silly ass. I'm not going to do it. But now that I saw my employer, it didn't matter. I was eligible to get my driver's license back. All I had to do was drive, and you don't understand. I'm lying. So you don't understand. You don't have to take tests for nothing. I take your time. You know, you hold my hand, and I'll find it. I thought I'd get my driver's license back. You don't have to do that without you. I'm grateful we have this program to get better than the normal people that you got with. I'm glad you guys have me here tonight and let me be a little bit of your society and take me in part of my Merry Christmas and Christmas.